Hey, glad you could join me. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation podcast. I hope you are doing well. Cabin fever? Well, let's hope your cabin is warm and you've got electricity. Stay warm out there, however you're doing it. This is, of course, the perfect time of year to be glad you bought a generator or laid in an extra cord of wood or something along those lines. Whatever it is, I hope you're safe. I hope you're enjoying what you can of the off season. We're going to talk a little bit about why we hunt. That's one of the goals this week. We'll explore that in all its details. Back by popular demand, today's podcast will be all about 10 questions from one of the listeners out there, Glenn Ainsworth. So hang on, Glenn, I'll be right to you in just a couple minutes. In the meanwhile, how you been? What you up to these days? My weekends are full of, a lot of magazine writing this time of year. So watch for that stuff to show up in the next 5 to 10, 12 months. That's how long it takes most of the time. But always fun to look back on what I did over the course of the season, or over the course of my career in hunting, and hopefully share something of value with readers. We got a lot more in that regard as well. But first off, here are the other things we'll be covering this week. Did a poll on how much hunting you did last season. Share that with you. See if, where you fit in that whole scheme of things. Are you really an avid hunter? How do you define it? We'll take some numbers and discuss that briefly. In our Handle It segment, the argument over pointing dogs and the sit command. Hopefully we'll put a cap on that today, or at least generate some food for thought. Our public access segment this week, I've got a rough grouse hotspot that most of you might have heard about, but maybe not quite as much information in your library as you'd like, plus a new resource to help you take advantage of it. It's all right here on the Upland Nation podcast. My weekend, like I said, writing and shooting. Without anything legal to shoot at anymore here, it's all about getting ready for next season, and I've been doing a lot of that, working on this instinctive style. Don Curry last week got me even more psyched up about it. This week, it's all about practicing, specifically the gun mount. You know, he mentioned something that really hit home for me, and maybe for you too. You know, we do all this work preseason or during the season. We try to be a good shooter, and then bird gets up and all bets are off. Well, that's because we haven't practiced our gun mount enough, at least in my case, maybe in your case too. There's a whole bunch of other aspects to it, of course. But rushing that gun mount, man, that really hit home with me, and I'm working on that a lot. Maybe you can, maybe you can't do it. I can leave an unloaded shotgun in my office, so anytime I need to stretch my legs, I can practice 3 or 4 gun mounts, and that's enough right there. You might be shooting trap or skeet, or you might be taking a lesson or whatever else, whatever it is. Keep that in mind. It's working for me so far. Maybe it'll work for you. Yeah, so what did you do this weekend? Well, many of you took my assignment to heart. You know, when I ask you every year on the Upland Nation Index survey why you go hunting, you know, killing birds is way down on the list. Second highest on the list, camaraderie, fellowship, being with family and friends, always a good time, whether you shoot anything or not. Okay, keep your remarks to yourself. So, on the Facebook page, I asked that question recently, and here are some of your responses. Tony Arneson, gold medal for you. There's a special place in heaven for people who take the kids out. The Treasure Valley Pheasants Forever Heritage Youth Hunt. Looked like you had blue sky, lots of folks in attendance. I hope everybody had a good time. I'm liking that comment right now. Jim Brame says, camaraderie with my dogs. Okay, I get it. And then he adds, and I've never found squirrel meat at the grocery store. Now that's a versatile dog for you. Karen Foote, looks like you got a little Brittany puppy there. Time spent with good friends and good dogs. That dog is carrying more bird than dog, I think, right there. Hunting buddy David Gilbertson. By the way, David, let's go this year. I'll see you at the Sporting Clays range very soon. But David is grateful for 10 years with Keeper. That's his Labrador. Grateful for hunt days together, but more so the hugs at night. Oh, I don't blame you. Gordon Vavrick says lots of chuckers this year. Great tailgate shot. Dog, three guys, multi-generational hunt there, and a smile on every one of them. Matt Templeton, I think I mentioned this one a while back, but it's always worth mentioning again. Spending time with my brother. Yeah, like I've said before, wish I could say that. Anyway, good job, everybody. Keep it up. Every week I'll be asking you a question first thing Monday morning that has to do with why we're hunting. And I hope you will keep sending photos and descriptions of why that all works, including, all right, one more. Greg Messer, me and my dad and our beagle Wags. Yeah, a beagle and a pheasant in the same picture. Yeah, do the math. It works. Keep it up. Thanks, everybody, for being a part of the Upland Nation and specifically that ongoing discussion of why we're all going out there. Okay, just about ready for Glenn and his 10 questions. How am I going to do this time? You know, are you keeping track? Are you keeping score? I'm trying to because I want to serve. And the only way to do that is to know things that I can pass on. So, Glenn, get your questions ready right after this. Sage and Breaker Gun Care products are crafted at the highest caliber. They're always offering free shipping on all their products, and their products are pretty darn incredible. Watch the videos, learn more about how to take care of your guns. Get on the mailing list, and you'll have the first shot at all the new gear when it first premieres. SageandBreaker.com. Yeah, so 10 questions. You know, I love this. I might be the only guy in the room who enjoys taking tests, but only when the tests are in subject areas that I love. Luckily, Glenn Ainsworth is on the line, and he's going to be administering the exam today. Glenn, welcome to the Upland Nation podcast.
No, thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
And how you doing these days?
I'm doing all right. Getting Coyote medicine reloaded up so I can go back out and do a little bit of that hunting since our bird season's over. So,
yes, it is. And quite a bird season it was for some people. I'm always jealous. I try to avoid going on all those Facebook pages too often because all I do is get envious of everybody else. Some of you folks are going to have to buy bigger tailgates or bring me along to kind of lower the odds. Glenn, whereabouts are you?
I'm in Ontario, Oregon.
Yeah, one of my favorite places to drive through.
It's a good place to be from.
Well, far away from?
Yeah.
You know,
yep.
Ontario gets
in the rear view mirror.
Yeah, it gets a bad rap. You know, Ontario's got a lot going for it. Number one, it's on the border with Idaho, so you're that much closer. Number two, there's a great Japanese restaurant. Number three, you're near Vail, Oregon, which is one of my favorite places because the one of the ranches I've made TV shows on is over there. It's got a lot going for it. So, you know, beyond all that, what kind of dogs you're running?
I have two Brittanys, one French, one American right now.
How do they get along? And do they bark with an accent?
Well, my little French Brittany girl, she likes to bark at everything that moves, but my old Brittany boy, he kind of like, whatever, get out of here.
Yeah, yeah. Sounds like the corgi.
They get along great.
Good. That's wonderful. Now, what did you go over to the French side for a reason, or was it just the most convenient way to go for the newer dog?
Well, I lost my old girl a couple years back, and I had been looking for a dog, and my older Brittany, who I actually adopted from American Brittany Rescue, he was a 5-year-old male. I got him out of Lewiston, and he's an excellent dog. Couldn't ask for anything better, especially in a rescue aspect of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you never know what you're going to get, and he's an excellent dog. My girl I got from Sunburst Brittany is over at New Plymouth, who they breed French Brittanys now, have for years, and I never had a French Brittany. I've had, you know, 10 or 11 American Brittanys since I was a kid. And I guess I just kept that line because Grandpa always had Brittany's, so I guess I needed to have Brittany's too.
Well, you're in good company.
I never had a Frenchie, and I like their little smaller size, but I will tell you, she does not have an issue keeping up with him.
Yeah, the French Brittany guys, they say something like, you know, a big dog in a small package or something like that. And, yeah, the ones I've hunted with, I wrote a story for Gun Dog Magazine about them a while back. All those dogs have been exactly what you've described, Glenn, and it's absolutely true. You know, the thing that I've been really curious about with them is, are they easy keepers in the off season?
Yes.
So they're
both of mine are, you know, they're house dogs.
Yeah.
They sleep in the same bedroom, and she's got a little crazy to her come about 9 o'clock at night. And it takes about 30 minutes for that zoomy effect to go out of her, I call it. But usually I'll just take her outside real quick, and they'll run around the yard real quick, and she's good to go for the rest of the night. But
yeah,
you know, she's got a little crazy in her.
I'm gonna check the clock because my wire is the same way. I just don't know if it's on a schedule like your dog's. You know, I got to put a plug in for our good friends at the American Brittany Rescue Organization. They've done a great job over the years, and they do a little bit more than most people when it comes to vetting the owners and investigating the dog's background. So I'm glad you had a good experience with that. And on that note, you know, I'm looking here at the time and thinking, hey, you got 10 questions. Let's get to number one on the list and see if I can help you out.
Well, okay. You know, you hear the term force fetch everywhere. What is it? What does it do? And why do you do it? And have I just been lucky and never had a Brittany not fetch a bird for me?
The answer is yes, you have been lucky, and that's a good thing. Force fetching is, and I know I'll start an argument or 10, but force is probably not the right word for it. And a lot of people are using other terms for it now. The conditioned retrieve is very fashionable now. Whatever it is, the point is the dog needs to understand then when you say, go get that they must go get it and bring it right back to you. The execution in a textbook sense would be the dog goes straight for that thing, picks it up, turns around, comes straight back to you, holds it in its mouth until you say, give it to me. So that would be the ideal execution of a forced retrieve, if you will. The term is being changed in many ways from force because a lot of people think force means pain, and a lot of old school trainers did use pain, the ear pinch or the toe pinch or things like that to get the dog to actually yelp and open its mouth so you could shove in a training bumper or a buck or something like that. And the dogs, of course, learned based on fear and pain. And, you know, I guess it worked, but there are better ways to do that. And I've experimented with them over the years and they all seem to work. So You know, if somebody is thinking about doing it, they ought to investigate all the ways to do it and find the one that works for them. I got to tell you, everybody who goes through it says the first thing that happens, believe it or not, is you and your dog, your relationship is taken up to a higher level as a result of going through that together. On the other hand, there are people who say, I'd never force fetch my own dog. I take him somewhere else. In fact, the guy I get my dogs from is the force fetch master for most of the other really good dog breeders in his area. So they'll job that out to him. So fundamentally, that's what it is. Go out, get it, bring it back. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Ideally, you hold that thing until I ask you to give it to me, et cetera, et cetera. That's a perfect force fetch. Force fetching mainly being the training method, but that's a perfect force retrieve right there. That does that muck up things more for you, Glenn?
No, I just, you know, I guess every one of my dogs that, you know, from fetching a ball from a puppy to all the way through, they bring it to me and I just say give, and they either drop it at my feet or it's in my hand, one of the two, and I guess I just never had to worry about it. So maybe I'm lucky.
Well, you are lucky, and that's a good thing. And of course, you know, it's just like, what is a finished dog? You know, to everybody, to each person, they have a different definition. You know, from a conservation and a sportsmanlike perspective, you want to know with confidence that if you kill a bird, you're going to get it back. You know, even if that means it's on the other side of an icy creek, somebody's got to go get it. It can be you or it can be the dog. And that's the fundamental motivation for force retrieves.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, so that was like an essay question. You have any multiple choice?
Well, maybe. So I know you have you run wire hair pointers.
Yeah.
Why did you choose that breed? And why? You know, what was your process in choosing which breed you have? You know, like I said, I had Brittany's and I had them all life. I just never really tossed around getting another one, unless it was a German short hair. But
yeah,
just wondering what your thought process is and why you chose the wire hair over a different breed.
Okay, my first the disclaimer is, thanks for the question first, Glenn. The disclaimer is, kids, don't try this at home. Most people don't do it the way I did it. We moved here for the fly fishing. My wife won the argument. She said, we're getting a dog. I want a dog. I said, okay. Can I pick the dog? She said, sure. We're driving down the main street in Bend, Oregon, and the back of a pickup is the ugliest animal I've ever seen. And I've seen some ugly animals. You know, I watch National Geographic Channel. I said, okay, thinking I finally might actually win the argument. I said, okay, I want one of those. She looked at it. She looked at it again. She said, pull over. So we parked right next to that pickup. Got a closer look at that dog. It was a friendly dog. And we're looking closer and closer, and out of the bank comes one of my wife's long-lost sorority sisters. And she says, Karen, what are you doing here? And she says, Nancy, what are you doing here? Well, we just moved here. We live here. What are you doing with my dog? Well, oh, my goodness. Ends up that dog not only was Nancy's dog, it was pregnant. So we got a dog. As I'm walking away with the puppy in my hands later that year, Nancy's husband, Buck, says, when are you going to start shopping for a horse? And I said, what? Well, you're going to field trial that dog, aren't you? I said, what's a field trial? And it went downhill from there. I could bore you from now till breakfast with the rest of the story, but suffice it to say, I found out that was a bird dog. And if that guy would do what he did for me the first time I put him in a bird field, unknowingly, I watched him work a bird and I said, I guess I'll go buy a shotgun. And that was that. So I warned you, that's not the way to shop for bird dogs. The right way is decide what kind of hunting you're going to do, decide where you're going to do it, and then start learning everything you can about the right kinds of dogs for that. For example, if I was living in South Dakota and I was going to hunt CRP and cut crops for ringnecks, I'd probably look seriously at a Labrador. But if I was going to hunt sharptails on the Pure National Grassland, I'd probably want a big running pointer. So be more strategic about those things and decide first if owning a bird dog is the right idea for you, because it is a lifelong commitment. Whew. Another essay question.
That's a cool story. I mean, you know, how you found out what dog you're getting. Your wife helped that situation out good.
Yeah, and she's never let me forget it either, by the way. To put the cap on it, because you asked why I picked them. Well, since then, I've never had anything but more and more reasons to own a wire hair. From the good looks, to their desire, to the fact that they got an on-off switch and you can usually reach it no matter where you are on the couch. So it's all of that stuff. For somebody else, it's something else. You have your own reasons for owning a French Brittany and an American Brittany. Other people love their pointers. It doesn't matter. If you love that breed and what that breed can do together with you, that's the breed for you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay,
so
2 out of 10.
All right. Well, let's the importance of family in hunting. Your grandpa, dad, yeah, your uncle, brothers, cousins, and for those that didn't have family to start them, what about friends? The importance of continuing that tradition.
It's critical. It's as if I wrote the script for you. Thanks, Glenn. You're asking all the right questions. I as you just heard, I'm what the hipsters would call an adult onset hunter. And I swear to God, I won't use that term again ever in the rest of the podcast. Because everybody is, to a great degree. If you were lucky, you had a grandpa or a dad. Generally, that's who it was. That's what the statistics tell us. Didn't have that. So I had to come to it the same way I came to fly fishing, you know, figuring it out for myself and making a lot of mistakes along the way. Still make mistakes, as you know, if you watch me on TV. But what I've come to believe, not only because I see it every year in my annual survey, but also every day when I'm talking to people, it's right up there. Watching your dog work, always number one. Being with friends and family, always number two. It is the reason we go. And I got some theories on this, and someday maybe it'll become more than just the foreword in my current book, and that is, we are still a tribe. You can describe it any way you like, whether it's your neighborhood, your family, your clan, your church group, whatever. We're still a tribe, and we need a tribe to basically lead a full and complete life. Our dog is a part of that tribe. So are other people. Sharing the hunting experience with our tribe is gratifying, not just from a fundamental standpoint, but also because in the day, and even now, to a degree, we're providing. And there's nobody I'd rather hunt with than good friends or family. Anybody out there going to argue with that? I didn't think so. How about yourself, Glenn? Who do you generally hunt with when you do hunt?
Right now, it's my brother and our best friend.
Yeah.
I lost my grandpa, both my grandpas back in the 90s, and my dad.
Yeah.
I lost my dad when I was 25, but they sure gave us a heck of a start. So.
Well, number one, you're lucky. You know that, so I'm not going to lecture you on that. But if you do have a chance to hunt with family, all the better. And if you don't, there's somebody out there who's looking for the same thing you are, I'll tell you. Find somebody out there who wants an experience, some fellowship, that camaraderie. There's nothing like it. And there's no, you don't get that playing golf. I can guarantee you. You don't get that playing softball on Thursday nights in the summertime. You get it when you're going out and trying to feed the tribe. I know there's nothing like it. I can't describe it anywhere near like the anthropologist can, but there is something to that. It's a shared experience that goes back to caveman days, for that matter. So there. Yeah.
Somebody had to teach somebody.
Precisely. And anybody who thinks that everybody else should learn it their own damn selves is a selfish SOB in my book. Oh, that's for yep. Andy, by the way. Andy, I hope you're listening, because I meant that for you.
Oh, Andy again.
Yeah.
I remember hearing him.
He's got... Yeah, I see. I can say Andy on a family-oriented podcast. I can't say the other word that starts with an A. Okay.
Not and get it probably. So.
Yeah. Somebody will get sensitive about it and go report me. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And they got them all over. So
yeah, we do.
So let's. I got something a little bit different, maybe that's not strictly upland related, but it's not talked about much than I've heard in, you know, several podcasts, different shows. How about your rig setup you go hunting with? Is it lifted? Tires, lockers, chains? What spare parts do you take with you? Do you put a winch on it? Extra gas? Survival supplies? Extra food, water? Fire starter stuff, etc. Do you keep all that in your rig? And what tips? Because out here in chucker country, you may not see another person for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
How important is it to have that rig set up properly where somebody that's hunting in South Dakota probably doesn't have to worry about too much?
That's a great question, Glenn, and I'm glad to answer it. It's funny you should mention it the day after I spent $1,200 getting my rig worked on from this past chucker season. By the way, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast, everybody. I'm Scott Linden, the host, and at this point, the test taker. Glenn is the administrator of the test, Glenn Ainsworth in Ontario, Oregon. The short answer to your question, Glenn, is everything you listed is on my truck. I'm lucky enough to have a one-ton Ram, and I love it all except for the computer that controls all the electronics. But I carry the fuel. It's diesel. It came from the factory a little bit lifted. It's got all that stuff and more on it. And I've used it all. My best buddy and music school partner from way back, we hunted together 3 times this year in chucker country. That's all we did this year. Actually, everything I did this year was chucker hunting. And I hunted every week for 5 months, except for 2 of those weeks. In the course of our hunt season together, we blew 8 tires. So, so the first thing I would add to your list is a second spare, because you're talking about the darkest place in America, the least populated part of America, that place where we all go chucker hunting. And you're right. You could be out there for days on end before anybody comes by to see how you're doing. So you want to be self-contained. And I think in everybody's case, it's different, but it's all those things you listed. I carry with me, in fact, I'm leaving it in the vehicle all the time, except when I'm hunting, then it's in my vest. And that is one of those emergency locators. I use a Spot because I've had it for years. When they were the only ones doing it, I bought one. Now there's the Garmin InReach, and my buddy just got one of those and he loves it. So if I break down in the middle of nowhere, whether I'm in the truck or I'm hunting away from the truck, I've got that thing with me. And if I need it, they'll send the helicopter for me. Other than that, it's water. Always have water with you for you and the dog. I carry something to sleep in if I need to. You didn't mention a sleeping bag or an emergency blanket or anything like that, but it gets pretty darn cold, and just sitting there in the truck, especially if it's broke down and the engine doesn't run, you're going to get pretty cold at night. So I would add those things, and then anything else you can carry. I mean, the running joke around here is you got a full-length bed, you got truck vaults underneath it, you got a cap on top of it, jam it full of stuff. Why not? Oh, and I keep a bottle of scotch in the back for after the hunt. We have one drink to toast the place and the people and the birds we're chasing. Then we go back to camp and have more than one drink.
Yep.
Can you think of anything?
What? This funny story about tires. Somebody asked my grandpa one time why he had four spares in the back of his Dodge pickup. He said, evidently you've never been in the Ion, which is what we call the Idaho, Oregon, Nevada, where it meets that big old circle between Winnemucca and Marching, Idaho, and Elko, Nevada, and Burns, Oregon.
Yeah, I know that country. Yeah, maybe I should carry four.
Yeah, but, yeah, it's that was a funny. That was back in the late 80s, right before I went in the Navy, and we were coming out, and two of them spares were gone. Shot the shreds, and Grandpa said, "That's why I have four."
you know, and I'll tell you, twice this most recent season, I used something else that I've never used before, and that's a plug for my tires, you know, so that at least you can limp out on that plugged tire and keep the spare intact if you need to. So add one of those plug kits to it, learn how to use it. It's not that hard. And just in case isn't enough, you'll have that as well. It's like an additional, it's like Aflac insurance on top of your other insurance.
Yeah, we plugged the hole with 22 of those things one time.
That might be a world record.
Well, we pulled in the local tire store, and they're like, "How'd that work?" I said, "It worked good. I'm here, right?"
Yeah, that's all you can hope for. That's exactly right. That's great. No. So that, yeah, you know, those are the things I take. I look at the truck as basically a giant survival kit. Again, I got a rack on top of it. I got a handyman jack. I got a shovel. I got a winch on the front. I've got a tow strap. I've never winched myself out of a fix, but I've winched 15 other people out of one fix or another. And that's enough for me.
Yep. That winch could save somebody.
Yeah, that's for sure.
It's kind of hard to tie to a tree in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, learn how to dig a hole and put a dead man in there, and that's the way to go. But you're absolutely right. So don't get in that fix unless you really need to get in that fix.
Exactly. So okay.
All right. So Upland Nation Podcast, Scott Linden here, Glenn Ainsworth there. Glenn, I think we're on question number 5, and right after that, we'll be covering that Handle It segment and the argument for and against sit. So stick around, everybody. Glenn, go ahead. Question 5.
Okay, weapon of choice. I know you like the over-unders, but when chucker and quail hunting, I always seem to need that third, fourth, fifth shot. Are you just a quick reloader? Or
no. First off, as you know, if you watch Wing Shooting USA on TV, I'm a really crappy shooter. And I'm a slow reloader. There are some things about break open guns I like. First off, they're kind of cool, and I shoot a side by side as often as I shoot an over and under, but I shoot them both. I like the fact that I can carry it open almost all the time until the dog gets birdie, or better still, goes on point. Everybody knows that you're safe, and believe me, a couple times this year, I'm glad that I was cognizant of that, and I was made aware of it by people who weren't as safe. No harm done, but it did remind me. Beyond that, I think gun choice is about what you're comfortable with and what you shoot well. I don't have any prejudices against semi-automatics or pump guns or single shots or anything else. It's a gun that you have confidence in, that you know you can shoot well, and that you can carry safely, and you don't mind dropping on a rock here or there. There are people who take, you know, $10,000 Perazzis into the field, and that's great. To me, that's almost a new Ranger for me. So everything's relative, and it's really a choice. And the same for gauge, to a great degree. If you're a sportsman, you know how far you can shoot a 28 gauge, and you're not going to shoot any farther. If you need all the help you can get, as many pellets in the air as you can shoot, shoot a 12 gauge. Some people go in between. There is a weight difference, and if you know maybe it's only a pound or even a half pound, but if you multiply that by 14 miles in a day, that's a lot of weight. Maybe it's important to you. What are you shooting these days?
Oh, especially packing my dad's old solid rib Auto 5.
Yeah.
Yeah. That gun, it'll drag you down. I always wonder why my dad let me pack that out going trucker hunting.
Yeah, you thought it was an honor. And ha!
Yeah, and he would take my 20 gauge, you know?
Yep.
And here, take this and swap me out. All right, cool.
And you know, I got to tell you. You know, I'll never forget. I was just for giggles. I brought an Italian. I was given. I can't afford these things. I was given an Italian field gun, an over and under by one company a few years back, and I brought it on a trip. We were making a show in Nebraska, and I thought, what the hell? I'm going to try this 12 gauge for a while, because I generally shoot a 20 for almost everything, and it was like that. It was like your dad's old gun, but that extra weight forced me to slow down my gun mount and slow down my gun swing. And I don't think I missed with that gun that day. So there's even something to be said for a big, heavy, you know, boat paddle kind of a gun.
Yeah, I bought my first Overrunner this year.
Well, good for you, and good luck with it.
I was shocked. I was like, yeah, I kind of like this.
Yeah, good.
I found myself digging out the old Browning when it comes time to take the dog pheasant hunting, though.
Well, you know, there you go. And it's funny you should bring it up like that, because I'm thinking of my music career. You know, there were certain composers where I played that instrument and certain composers when I played that instrument, just because it felt right. And that, again, goes back to that whole idea, shoot the gun you have confidence in. And that will overcome almost anything short of a bent barrel or, you know, cross dominance. Okay, so Glenn, yep. you get a chance to cook up five more questions. I know you got them already, so you can make them harder or lighter as you deem fit while I continue on. Take a quick break for you, Glenn. We'll come back to five more questions right after a quick break and our Handle It segment. So just don't ever forget, the most important aspect of your hunt is always your dog and your dog's performance. That's why Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food is my kibble of choice. Tim Hunt is a veterinarian. He's a sled dog racer. He knows how important performance is. He knows how important diet is to performance. He started by mixing it all up in a concrete mixer. Yeah, just like when we lay a little sidewalk or something. Over the years, it's gotten a little bit more sophisticated than that, with the goal always being formulate a food that replicated a natural wild diet for his dogs. Well, it still works. I'm a big fan of the Momentum formulation. There's one for every dog at every life stage. Dr. Tim's Performance Dog Food has won the Iditarod Sled Dog Race multiple times. They'll deliver it right to your porch. And if you use the code Upland Nation, you get 30% off your first order. Believe me, it will not be your last order. DRTIMS.com. And if you're looking to save a buck or two, go to UplandNationDeals.com. I'm so excited about this site. This is a chance for you to buy good quality, brand name, professional level gear. It's lightly used, so you get it at a great price. And if you're just getting started in this business, you know how expensive the pro level stuff is. Well, you can get it at Upland Nation Deals, slightly used, UplandNationDeals.com, at about half the price you'd pay for the new stuff. It's all guaranteed, free shipping on your first sale or purchase, pro-level gear at entry-level prices, UplandNationDeals.com. Yeah. All I'm going to do is prolong the agony here. The argument among pointing breed owners over whether to sit or not. I mean the dog, of course, you know that. And you probably have your own opinion on it, and I'm not going to change that. But if you're new to this world or you're just wondering what the rationale is, here's my point. And by the way, Handle It is brought to you by Happy Jack Dog Care Remedies. You got a problem with your dog? Save yourself a trip to the vet. In most cases, check them out at happyjackinc.com, happyjackinc.com. All right. Some dogs are smart enough, hard-headed enough, something in between, to where when you say sit and they sit, they're not going to translate that to the field or to a training situation where they sit when they're not supposed to. And fundamentally, that means when they're on point or they're backing another dog on point. That becomes the problem. Softer dogs and confused dogs. And I'll never forget my first dog before he was fully trained, if he was ever fully trained, he would stop in the middle of the field and sit down and look at me for direction. I should have learned back then, but it took me up until Buddy, my third dog, to put two and two together. A lot of times a dog that is a little soft or a little confused will sit, and you don't want that happening when they're standing a bird. The alternatives, if you need to absolutely positively have your dog not go anywhere, well, you know one of those words, WHOA, or in a lot of cases, you can have that dog lie down instead. Try one of those. Remember that a dog that's confused or soft may be sitting because he's confused or soft. All right. And the exam continues. 10 questions. We're 5 questions through it. Glen Ainsworth in Ontario, Oregon. Are you hanging on with me?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm still here.
Okay. So tell me, did you change any questions? Make them harder, make them easier. Hopefully.
Might try to change a few of these up so I'm not going in line.
Oh, I don't mind any of them so far. So go ahead. This will be about number 6 here at the Upland Nation podcast. Go ahead.
In your opinion, all right, so I've known some excellent trap and skeet shooters. And when I went out in the field and hunted with them, they seem to get spanked an awful lot by the wily rooster and the quail and chucker. What do you think that is?
There's probably 1,000 answers to that one, Glenn. But having been an even worse shooter than I am now and having taken a lot of lessons and seen a lot of gunners and having gunned at a lot of field trials and hunt tests, here are my theories. First off, remember that if you shoot a lot of clay targets, you're used to a target that comes out of the thrower really fast and slows down as it goes farther away. Whereas a bird builds speed as it gets higher and higher. So you're tracking the target differently, and the target is behaving differently. So that might throw off a lot of clay target shooters. The other one is this sheer size. Unless you're gunning quail, every bird you're shooting at is bigger than those clay targets. And I think that has a lot more to do with it than many people think. And the reason I tell you that is my own empirical evidence. I'll shoot Hungarian partridge 4 or 5 times a year, for example. Now, if you know what huns look like, you know they're bigger than a quail, but they're smaller than a chukar, and they're way smaller than a ringneck or even a sharptail, for that matter. When those birds get up, I don't know if they're close, far, or somewhere in between, because my head can't dial in on that. So I think there's some of that as well. And then just to give them a break, I've been there and done that enough to know there's a hell of a lot of pressure on a gunner in the field, let alone at a hunt test or a field trial, but all of the above. You got an audience of 1, 2, 5 plus a dog. Everybody's looking at you, and you are a little bit on the, you've got some performance anxiety. I think there's some of that there. All of that combined with the fact that we have a lot more experience over the course of a lifetime shooting at little black clay targets than we do at gaudy birds of any sort. It's that as well, just the sheer experience, because those birds, most of them, one of their primary survival mechanisms is to either throw your head off or your ears off. The reason birds make a lot of noise when they get up, especially in a covey, but even singles, is to distract you, to throw your eye and your mind off just enough to where they can get another 50 feet away from you. And it works. Those are some of my theories, Glenn. Everybody has their own. And by the way, that doesn't even include the moon got in my eyes, or the bird flew out of his scent cone.
Yeah, that's funny. But no, I kind of agree a little bit of that, because I don't care how many times I walk up on my dog's pointing, heart always seems to skip 3 or 4 beats when that bird comes up.
Yeah, you know, it's
so you're already just like, oh no.
You know, and here's one I learned this every time I miss. Where some shooting methods will suggest that you shouldn't be looking at the dog, or you shouldn't even be looking at where you think the bird is. You should be looking at where you think the bird's going to fly. Because if you're going to try and catch up with that bird by swinging your gun muzzle toward it, he's gone by then. So look where the bird is going to go, not where the bird is.
Well, that's a good idea, actually.
Easier said than done, of course.
But, yeah, because, man, I'll tell you what, chukar have been kicking my butt for almost 40 years.
Yeah, I know the feeling. My butt hasn't been kicked quite that long, but I know the feeling, because, of course, on top of everything else, you're tipping over most of the time when you're taking a shot on devil birds.
Yeah, and unless you just get lucky and catch them in the saddle. But so the other thing, chukar for the young.
Yeah.
I'm almost 50. It's harder to stay in shape. And I question this because my grandpa's in his mid-70s, and he was a smoker, and he was still chukar hunting when he finally decided they'd had enough. And my biggest secret to that is I remember now why my grandpa was still hunting.
Mm-hmm.
Because we always found a way to get to the top and not walk it.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, if I could figure out how to do that, I'd probably make $1 million transporting everybody else. But yeah, I mean, it gets harder with age. There's no doubt about it. But it depends on what you really want out of life. You know, I'm not bragging, but I'm going to tell you, in the last year, I lost 26 pounds. I started working out a lot more frequently and at a greater intensity. And I had the best chukar season of my life. None of the hills scared me. They were hard, but they were no harder than anything I did when I played football or was a distance runner or anything else, because I was in better shape. And if you're in better shape and can figure out a way to get to the top without walking the whole way, more power to you. You're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. That's Glenn Ainsworth over there. He's calling me from Ontario, Oregon. What else do you think we need to do to become a more mature chukar hunter, Glenn?
I don't know the answer to that. Because I don't know, if as long as you're chukar hunting, you'll never be mature.
Yeah.
Because it's a child's game, and you got to keep that mentality to look at that hill and like, yeah, I can do that.
There you go. I mean, there's a perfect motivation right there, though, isn't it? You know, 2 years ago, I said, you know, I want to be hunting these hills until I'm 70 years old as well. So how am I going to do that? I'm going to go work out more.
Yeah, there's a definitely got to stay young in the mind in order to get up that mountain now.
Yeah, and obviously there are all sorts of other benefits as well, but that is absolutely correct.
But another thing, do you take your dog everywhere? Unless you're going shooting or rifle hunting?
Well, I don't hunt anything but birds. So if I'm going hunting, my dog is certainly with me, or else he'd change the locks on the doors and I wouldn't be allowed back in. But yes and no. There are times when I'm dog free. You know, if I'm going to town for a couple hours or something like that, I'll even go a weekend somewhere, but only when it's not a hunting trip. I think there is something to be said for the bond between a dog and its owner. I think that pays off every time you're training that dog, and I think it certainly pays off when you're hunting with that dog. There's a connection there that you can't get any other way than to be in the same room or be on the same field and looking at each other and sending that mental telepathy both directions. You got two. Might be a little bit harder for you, but do you take your dogs to town?
I do.
Yeah.
My wife's like, why are you taking them? Because they want to go too.
Yeah. Yeah.
They it don't matter if we're actually going hunting or just riding around town. They like to go.
Yeah, I think so.
And they ride in the back of the cab. And I don't, unless it's a long trip, they're not, I don't put them in kennels. Just ride around town. They just stay right in the cab with me. But
yep. You know, it's funny. We all have reasons not to do it, but they're almost always silly reasons. It's not like it takes much longer to get your dog into the truck than it takes to get your sorry butt in the truck. So why not let him go along? If you are a crate-oriented person, you can put those crates in the back seat, or you can put them in the back of the truck, whatever it is. I'm lucky enough to have some of those Mud River seat covers on top of my other seat covers. So I don't even have the excuse of getting the truck dirty. And with all those together, all of a sudden it's just as easy to bring a dog along. And they'll learn something. They'll keep the bad guys out too.
They're always watching, that's for sure.
Yeah, have you ever noticed what's that? You go into the store, they're staring at the door to the store you went into. And
oh yeah.
And when you come out, they're still staring at that door.
Well, Toby, when I come out of the store, I'm usually driving. And I'm like, wow. Somebody said, that's a pretty good looking driver. Yeah, now if I can just teach it, hit the brakes, we'd be good.
Oh, I got to tell you this one. So way back when automatic headlights first came on the scene. And so you never had to turn them on and you never have to turn them off because you just park. And when you shut the door and lock it, the headlights will stay on for 10 seconds and then they'll go off. Well, I parked and I got out and my dog got into the driver's seat and actually even put his feet up on the wheels, on the steering wheel. And I'm walking into wherever I'm going and somebody hits me on the shoulder and says, hey, your lights are still on. And I turned around, I looked at him and I looked at the dog. I said, don't worry, he'll take care of it. I waved at the dog and about then the lights went off. That person didn't quite know what to say.
That's funny right there. So, all right. I've never been to South Dakota hunting. I've traveled that country for a lot of years, but I've never got the opportunity to stop and go hunting. But I want to take my dogs, and a lot of the places I see, the lodges and stuff like that, are almost like guided hunts.
Yeah.
They have dogs provided. How do you go about, I want to go hunt this place, but I want to use my dogs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And are there places that allow you to, or is it just all set?
Yeah. No, there's,
you know,
it runs the gamut. If you want to go to a hunting lodge, many of them will let you bring your own dog. Most of them probably won't let you keep that dog in the room with you, although that is number one on the list of lodge visitors. That's what they want most of anything. But at least you can bring your dog. He can sleep in your truck or he can sleep in their kennel if you like. It depends. Most of them will let you bring that dog on the hunt as long as he's well-mannered and trained. The sticky points become if you're at many of these lodges, really it's a big gang of hunters. You know, there's 12 drivers and 8 posters and you know, you got all these Labradors running around in standing corn or cut corn and it's a mob scene. And it works only because the guides orchestrate it very carefully. I don't think I'd want my dog on a hunt like that unless it was a flushing breed and he could get along with all the other dogs. But there are places, and I've been to a million of them, where you can take your dog or your two dogs, in your case, Glenn, and go with a guide and maybe one other hunter and do a real pointing dog-oriented hunt. Hunt the cover there. Find the objectives there. Not have to walk down a row of corn or anything like that. And so you just need to ask around. You know, find 5 places you like. Call them all and ask them, what kind of hunting do they do? Number one, do they allow well-trained client dogs along? And where's my dog going to stay when I'm there? And if you get good answers to all 3 of those, man, you're golden. And I've seen it happen in every state, including South Dakota. There's also places, there's an outfit called U-Guide, letter U-Guide, where they basically have arrangements with a bunch of landowners and places to stay. And then it's a self-guided hunt. And you could run chihuahuas if you want because nobody else is there. So all of those. And then there's wild bird land that's publicly accessible all over the Midwest. South Dakota, Montana, North Dakota, Kansas, they all have walk-in programs where you can do whatever you like and you can stay at a local hotel. And all of those are options for you, Glenn.
Yeah, I may have to look into it a little harder next year.
Yeah, but
provided COVID releases us.
Yeah, all of the above. And in fact, start digging now because I'm predicting there will be an incredible amount of pent-up demand out there because a lot of those lodges basically had no season, which means their clients or their potential clients are chomping at the bit right now.
Yeah.
All right. Whereabouts are we? Are we so, like 8? Question 8, maybe?
So yeah, somewhere in there.
All right.
So with that, all the public ground that's back there,
mm-hmm.
and your hunting spots website.
Yeah.
Is it tied to a program like Onyx that you could download that onto like your GPS or stuff like that, or is it a separate program that you could do anything with? Or
well, let's address that. That website, findbirdhuntingspots.com, which by the way is really shooting up there on the Google listings now. If you're looking for bird hunting spots, it's almost always at the top of the list now, which thank you all for making that. It's more general in its descriptions, and that's on purpose. I'm not going to give you latitude and longitude, but I'm going to tell you to go north of that town and look for these kind of walk-in areas or whatever. And then it's up to you. Here's what I've learned. Those mobile mapping apps like Onyx are wonderful. And I finally went over to one and I'm using it for certain things. So the first thing I learned, and the reason I never used it until this season, is still true. They don't update those walk-in areas very often. They rely on the bureaucrats at each state to provide them with the data that says, yeah, this year, here's a walk-in area, here's a walk-in area, here's a walk-in area on the map. Nobody's doing that on a frequent basis. And as we have all learned, if we use those programs, a lot of those walk-in areas, the deals aren't done until mid-August. So if your Onyx app was updated in June, you're SOL. I always recommend, when it comes to finding walk-in areas, go to each state. They all have an online hunting atlas. They usually have a hard copy version, and most of them have a mobile version as well now. Use those, because those are going to be 100% up to date, current as of that hunting season. And believe me, they are a treasure chest. You open the cover of those hard copies and there are little blue spots or little green spots all over the place. You can drive 1 mile or 50 miles from wherever you are and find all sorts of great places to hunt. And they're all free.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, so don't trust your mobile phone completely.
Yeah, I don't. I actually have that on my actual Garmin GPS. I don't mm-hmm. put it on my phone.
Yeah.
I go to way too many places where if you relied on Onyx on your phone and didn't get it downloaded properly, you're SOL.
Yeah.
Because there ain't no cell phone service out there.
Yeah. And saving that stuff offline, which I'm still learning how to do, is a pain. And it doesn't work near as well as it should for guys who cover hundreds of miles of driving in a day. So, bear all of those things in mind. There are limitations to all those online mapping apps. The one that bothers me most is you're relying on the state government to provide the Onyx guys with their updated list of walk-in areas. And when could you ever count on the state to do anything in a timely manner except collect your income tax?
Erase them.
Oh, you're listening. Speaking of that, you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Glenn Ainsworth is grilling me 10 questions, which is it's more fun than we should be allowed to have with our pants on. But here we are. Glenn, number 9 on your list.
Well, what do you suggest hunters do to address loss of habitat and where they live? Mm-hmm. You know, be it changing farming practices or fire regime on public grounds. For instance, you know, right here in Malheur County where I live, in the 70s and 80s, we had pheasants and a population of pheasants that would rival a lot of numbers in South Dakota, North Dakota, Nebraska, places like that. They're not so there's not so many of them around anymore around this country. Certain areas have them, certain areas have concentrations of them, but do you encourage hunters to join conservation groups to help improve local habitat, or do you suggest them just try to do stuff on their own on places that they have access to?
Yes and yes. And I well remember those days over there because I had just come into this world and missed out on the heyday of great pheasant hunting out your way, whether it was sugar beet fields or back then you were still growing a lot of corn out there. So, you know, all of those things I'm lamenting that I was that term that I promised not to use again on this podcast. Anyway, so number one, the biggest bang for your buck is always going to be joining those groups. And you know which ones I mean, everything from Pheasants Forever to the Quail Upland and Wildlife Federation to, you know, whatever your species of choice is, join them. More importantly, get active at the local level with the local chapter, form your own chapter, and then see what you can do literally at the grassroots level, because there's still a lot going out there. And you know, I see this every day. I watch these organizations, both the, you know, the big ones and the little ones, the Idaho Chukar Foundation, groups like that. They all have a mission, and they try their best to execute that mission as well as they can all year. So get active on the local level with those organizations, and then who knows, maybe there's something you can do on a, you know, a person-to-person basis, but there's always more effectiveness in big numbers than small numbers. The other thing that I might suggest is the squeaky wheels do get the grease. When it comes to local decision-making as far as habitat and things like that by your local game and fish department, if you are diplomatic about it, you got a good chance as any of getting your local biologist to figure out a better way to do something over there and ignore that problem over there. It's all about working together, and that's why maybe a local chapter allying with your game department is probably the best combination of circumstances. Hey, we got another question left, plus the public access segment I've got on a rough grouse hotspot. But all of that happens after Glenn gives me number 10.
Number 10. Oh. Well, uh-oh. I don't think I have another one written down.
Well,
Let me just toss this out there. So I know we know you like to fly fish and bird hunt. What other hobbies do you have that take you in the outdoors? Hiking?
That's a good question, and I don't mind answering it. Yeah. Of course, those are the things I live for. That's the stuff I do. That's why I am where I am. And as you well know, when we're not hunting with our dogs, we're training our dogs. So that's right up there as well. And I do shoot clay targets. And then my wife and I have become real fans of chasing pictographs and petroglyphs. Rock art, you know, the stuff you see on National Geographic, that sort of stuff. We're lucky enough to be in an area where there's a lot of that stuff. We've got some resources available to us, but more importantly, it gives you an excuse to go out during the off season, poke around in places where the rattlesnakes and the golden eagles live and have a good time. And so that would probably be right up there as well.
Well, you ever get a chance to come over this way during the summer, I can take you to some of them.
I appreciate that.
In the Owyhee Canyonlands.
Yes, in fact.
I stumbled on some by sheer accident, by being stupid, and going down a draw after a deer I probably shouldn't have went down, and looked up, it's like, oh, wow. that's cool. Then I tried to figure out how to get out of there.
Yeah. It sounds like one of my chucker hunts out in that country last year. I learned the term cliffed out. I'd never thought of that before, but you know, you've been up there, you've been on a spot and you realize I can't get down, or the other way around. I can't get up. Worse yet, neither can my dog. So,
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, you just described one of the coolest parts about what we do. And that is we're walking around in places where somebody was walking around 3, 5, 8,000 years ago, and they were so bored they scratched a picture of a spaceman or a sun or a snake on the rock. We might be the first people to see that in hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And I'm thinking in particular of one place where I was climbing hand over hand with my gun in my vest. And the first thing I realized was, that's a golden eagle nest. It's about 8 feet across and about 6 feet tall. And then I looked to the other side of the canyon, and there was the biggest spaceman pictograph I'd ever seen. So we have this kind of discovery all the time when we're hunting, and we have our dogs to thank for it, because we wouldn't be there unless we were trying to find our dogs most of the time. So that's what I do. How about you? When you're not fishing or hunting, what are you doing, Glenn?
Working.
Trying to pay for all that.
I don't really fly fish much anymore. I grew up over in Central Oregon.
Okay.
And over there, Grandpa, we were fly fishing all the time. My uncle and cousin, who are gunsmiths over there, still do the fly fishing, steelhead fishing, stuff like that. But I moved over here and pretty much became a bass fisherman.
Well, you got some incredible...
So I'm one of the guys in the bass boat running down lake at 70 miles an hour getting cussed out by all the trout fishermen.
I think I know what lake you're talking about, too. In fact, the first television series I ever hosted was for somebody else, and it was out there doing a bass fishing show.
Really?
Yeah, I won't bore you with all the details, but that was something else. And you're in the right place if you love to hunt, fish for bass.
Yes, sir. The couple of these reservoirs got some pretty good bass in them.
Oh, yeah. That's spectacular. Well, soon enough. I mean, you guys are probably already looking at spawn and when you're going to get out there for it. Hopefully the ice will clear before then, but we'll see. Glenn, this has been a lot of fun. Everybody else, I hope you had as much fun as I did with Glenn's 10 questions. We got more to talk about. I've got a survey from our Upland Nation Insights newsletter that I want to share with you. And then, like I said, the public access segment coming up right after a quick break. Glenn, thank you so much for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate it and had fun doing it.
Thank you. So did I. Yeah. What? In English, that means, hang on, we got a lot to talk about. Right after this word from Gunner.com, Gunner Kennels, that's what you know them for, first and foremost, have been tested and proven. Saving dogs' lives in real accidents. Watch some of the videos, take a look at some of those still images. You'll understand exactly what I'm talking about. You want early access to their exclusive offers? Sign up for their mailing list. You'll be the first to know. While you're there, take the Fit Finder quiz, do some virtual reality gaming with your dog and the kennel, figure out which one's going to fit where. It's all at gunner.com. So every week I ask you a question in the Upland Nation Insights e-letter. Once in a while, I'll pull stuff out of the Upland Nation Index, our annual survey. You know the one, got about 35 questions in it. Thank you if you took that survey. Sure appreciate it. Where do you stand on this on this continuum? I asked the question, how many days did you hunt this season? You think you're avid? Well, let me put it this way. The average bird hunter spends less than 10 days in the field. Congratulations, you're way above average. I can almost guarantee it. If you're listening to the Upland Nation podcast, you live, breathe, and eat bird hunting. Okay, so the question, how many days did you hunt? 29% of respondents said between 7 and 15 days a season. 31%, a third of you said 16 to 25 days. Another 23% said 26 to 40 days a season. Yeah. And then 16 more percent said they hunt more than 41 days a season. Yeah. Okay. You deserve the hat, you know, the eat, sleep, hunt hat. Congratulations and keep up the good work. Okay. So, This Land Is Your Land is brought to you by findbirdhuntingspots.com. That's the website where we've got all sorts of advice on finding free public access, plus some training and dog care advice, and a few bits of gear advice and some other tips, a product review here and there, and a little bit of everything else. Okay, so I know Park Falls, Wisconsin is well known in the ruffed grouse world as the ruffed grouse capital of the world. And even if you're not a ruffy hunter, you've probably at least heard of it. You know, they got that giant ruffed grouse downtown. And the thing is, it's more than just a proclamation. They've actually intensively managed that ground for ruffed grouse and woodcock habitat. Yeah, they do that out there in many ways, particularly in the Chickamauga Nicolet National Forest. Evergreens plus aspens, perfect habitat, especially when they start logging it off and clear cutting so that there's various ages of forest out there. Now, the nice thing is they've mapped a lot of the walking trails. Yeah, it's very civilized in the upper Midwest when it comes to rough grouse hunting. In the wintertime, the snowmobilers are using it, but in the fall, it's all about hunters. You can get those maps. You can access all of those seated mode and no motor vehicles allowed areas by getting their atlas. Go to dnr.wisconsin.gov and then just poke around and look for that rough grouse habitat map. Park Falls, Wisconsin, one of those places you really ought to take a look at if you love chasing the king of game birds. Glenn Ainsworth, thank you for your questions. I know I learned something. I hope everybody else did too. Thank you for participating in the way of listening and perhaps putting your own 10 questions together. We'll do that again. Sure enjoyed doing it. Again, thank you all for listening. If you liked it, tell your friends. If you didn't like it, send me an email or comment in one way or another. Talking to you every day on the Wing Shooting USA and the Upland Nation Facebook pages. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us on Apple Podcasts. Hey, you can get us on Spotify and iHeartRadio as well. This week's quote comes from Alphonse Toussenel. This might have been the second most original version of this I've seen. The more one gets to know of men, the more one values dogs. Can I get an amen? Thanks for listening to the Upland Nation podcast. Until we meet again, give your dog a hug, give your spouse a bigger hug, and seeing the field. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks again for listening.